Welcome back to the TV Talk Machine podcast. I'm Jason Snell, and across the internet from me, your host, chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Tim Goodman. Hello.
Hello, Jason.
I even kept the intro tight and bright this time.
I know. I felt it.
It's a classic intro. We got a lot to do. One of the problems about doing this podcast on Fridays is I feel like you and I sometimes are dragging at the end of the week. It's like, hey, welcome to the podcast. We're tired, which is nobody wants to hear that. 194 episodes in, they really don't want to hear that. But we do have something exciting to talk about that I'm so thrilled to finally be able to talk to you about, which is season two of Amazon's not hit drama, Sad Spies, not called that, Patriot.
It's back. Yes,
it's back.
And I name dropped you in my review.
I saw that. That's always really weird for me when I'm like, oh, I wonder, he could. Oh, he did. All right.
Yeah.
But the Sad Spies, like, you know, it's a better title. And please do some search engine optimization for Sad Spies because that needs to take off. But it's back. I watched episode one last night, so I have not watched more than that. But in that episode, I was like, oh, yeah, it's back. Like everything.
Oh,
there's a nice recap of season one where you're like, oh, yeah, that happened. Oh, right. Oh, boy. Like, it is such a great roller coaster ride where you recall everything that happened in season one. Like, oh, this show, right? And then it just keeps going. Like, it just picks up where it left off, and it just keeps doing the same crazy stuff that it did in season one.
I know. It was... I was delighted by... I can't remember now if I texted you or if I just sent you something. I can't remember. Well, the moment that I saw exactly how sad it was going to be, I said, oh, we're back, everybody.
Yep.
And
I think you tweeted something like, Jason will be happy to know that they are still very sad spies.
They're still so sad. And so, you know what? I will say this, that compared to a year plus ago when we did this, talked about it and did the review of it, you know, and then we were actually, it's actually longer than a year because I think the review came out, we talked about how much we liked it over the course of that year. And then we talked a lot more about it towards the end of the year when it was on my best of list. But now that it's back, I just see more people popping up even in my mentions on my Twitter, feed, because I think it just had time for people to sink in. They had a chance to catch up with season one. And some really big fans, you know, it's interesting, a lot of blue check marked people who have jobs around the globe. I laughed. I was like, are you affiliated with the show? Nope. Is this person affiliated with the show? No, they're like bureau chiefs and things all around. It's just everybody kind of got it really into it, and it's making a comeback. I'm really happy to know that, and I knew that before I wrote the review, that Amazon was totally on board with it. Jennifer Salke, who is running the show there, is a big fan of the show. In fact, I had emailed her a thing where I had been writing so many great things about Amazon. My running joke with her is that, like, I'm waiting for them to do something bad so that I don't have to review it, or I can review it and get some, you know, some distance. And then I said, and I haven't even watched Patriot yet. And she was like, Patriot's great. And then after I watched it, I was like, oh. And the review came, and of course she loved it. But everybody seems to be at Amazon, who's a fan of that series, is really a fan of that series, which I think is a good sign going forward.
Yeah, that's good, because that was the question, right? They've had all that turnover there, and they already ordered a second season. It's like, do they, you know, are they just going to run it off and then walk away from it and forget about it and move on to something else?
Yeah, and I think I said in the review that the only negative to me is it's only 8 episodes as opposed to 10, but I think that might have been, you know, might have been a timing thing. It might have even been pre-regime, and it'll give them a chance to. I have a feeling that it's going to get a third season. I don't know how quickly this new regime picks up shows, but they are solid, solid, solid on the shows that they've got coming back. I know that they're big on Man in the High Castle. It's already been picked up for season 4. So hopefully the Patriot one will follow. But to your point, yes, season 2 is really good. I think that they're having a little bit, you know, I think Stephen Conrad, who created, wrote, and directed all these episodes, is having, you know, had, I think, time to really gather himself for season 2, and he's got a little more swagger. They try more things. There is some visual humor that makes me laugh so hard.
There's, oh my god! I wanted to say there's a little footnote here. We talk about Sad Spies, and you're like, I don't need to see another soul crushing show about anybody, let alone spies. And it's like, but you got to understand, it is really funny. Like, it is I would say maybe the closest analog I can come up with something like maybe like a Coen Brothers movie where people are sad and it's existential. And mm-hmm. yet you know, in some of those Coen Brothers movies, they can also be really funny, sometimes darkly funny, sometimes broadly funny. It's kind of like that. There are moments. I mean, I laughed out loud multiple times at episode one.
Yes.
And not just because people are so sad or the terrible things are happening, but also just because of the ridiculous things that and the surprising things that happen. So it's not a slog to watch one this show. It is delightful, even though the characters are so sad.
Yeah, and it is I will say this too, I laughed harder at some of the physical gags that I had in season one, and because it just later in this, and I haven't finished everything yet, I'm like too shy, but There is a physical joke later that combines with kind of the melancholy, sad spy stuff that we love and the existential part. I mean, I love the existential part, but just the sad face that Michael Dorman carries around. Oh, he's
sad man in a suit, as the little girl
exactly.
calls him.
Exactly. And the little girl has a bigger role this year, yeah. which is interesting. And he has, so there's a scene where I had been like laughing inside for so long because it's just getting exponentially worse, mm-hmm. and things are going exponentially bad at every turn, that I was laughing because I was like, they must know, Stephen Conrad, the creator and writer, director, must know that like there's so much on his shoulders at this point, and then there's a physical joke that plays into that. And there's a look that happens on his face before it happens, so that when the physical thing that I didn't think was going to happen happened, I literally paused the TV and like rolled over in my bed laughing, because it's such a pile on. It's just such a pile on of the stuff that he's absorbed that I couldn't believe that I wasn't expecting it to happen. And, you know, it's in French, and so there's a little dialogue lag. And as I'm reading the dialogue, the joke happens, and I died laughing. And I thought, God, I love this show so much.
There's a moment, you talk about things getting increasingly bad. There is a moment in the recap that they put in that I thought is really smart, because it's essentially the premise of the show, which is, you know, he's sent to do this thing where he's got to take some money and give it to somebody. Like, that's the whole mission, is take some right. money and give it to somebody. And of course it goes wrong, but the point is, he in the previously clip is, oh, okay, you take some money and you give it to somebody, and he says, no, it's never that simple. And it begins unraveling from the moment he gets there, before he's even out of the airport in Luxembourg. And it just, and now, you know, here you've got 10 episodes in the first season, 8 episodes in the second season, where it all continues to just kind of unravel and try to make it better. And there's some great little moments. And you mentioned the use of French with subtitles is so great. There is this totally bizarre little side aspect of this. So in the first season, there was this subplot about how this woman who is a homicide detective in Luxembourg is investigating basically our main character. In this season, it seems, or at least in the first episode, they like double down on that, where we go back to the fact that this police department has the homicide squad that's made up entirely of women, and then there's this violent crime squad that's entirely men, and yes. they compete with each other. And there's this amazing moment where the men are deciding that they are going to investigate, since the homicide detective has disappeared, they're going to investigate what's happening. And they refer to themselves as, like, now the amazing men of superheroism will take the case. And you're reading the subtitles going, like, did they actually say that? I don't care. It's hilarious. It's so strange. Because instead of these women, and the way they're sexist, but they're like ludicrously sexist.
Yeah, ludicrously
and you
sexist.
Don't know whether that's cultural or the translation. And it doesn't matter. It's just weird and funny. And meanwhile, the women in the homicide group are also having their conversation about it. The stockings and whatever. Like it's
skirts and stockings.
Yeah, the skirts and stockings. They have a sort of derisively named for the all women homicide squad. It's like there's so much in this, and I haven't even mentioned like Kurtwood Smith is so great as this very cranky guy who's a former addict who's put his life together. And we get a flashback in episode one where his son is in France and he wants to see his son, and he says, "Look, I'm clean now. I got a good job. Everything's fine." But of course, this is a flashback, and he gets shot in the face, Dick Cheney style. And we know that he is on all of the drugs in the hospital now, so his sobriety is basically ruined, and he's stealing other people's IV drips in order to get more drugs. And so, like, there's that whole tangent, which is, I mean, it is. There's too much here. It is. It is so good, and on so many different levels.
I will say I know our listeners are going to be thinking this, but I will to amplify those points that you just made. I will amplify two things. One is that there's a future Kurtwood Smith joke that is so brilliant. I'm starting to cry just thinking about it. I kept thinking, like, how much fun did Kurtwood Smith have shooting this scene? And it's also, there's this ability, I think Stephen Conrad has this ability to put you in a preposterous situation, right? Because so much of Patriot is like preposterous in its everything going wrong.
Yeah, you're putting people who are thinking and interesting characters, and how do you react? Like the whole show is like, how are you going to react to this, smart guy?
Right. And there's a moment with Kurtwood Smith where I thought, oh my God, I love that this scene was so great that you would think that a lot of people wouldn't have gone to it. But I just thought of the actor and how much fun he must have had shooting that. And then there is, I think for the first time, and I kind of referenced this in my review, there was a very like broadly physical, visual and physical humor joke that Stephen Conrad used. And I remember the moment it started, I think the sound I must have made was like, oh, I'm like, I can't even believe they're doing this. But of course, moments later, they quadruple down on it. And I thought, okay, so that's a show that's really comfortable with itself, because it's taking this visual joke to the extreme. And I just loved it. And as you know, and you'll see as anybody watches it, that this year they really lean into the folk song stuff.
Oh yeah, and we haven't even mentioned that he basically is like the main character fancies himself a singer songwriter and will make up songs about his mission as a spy, which is a bad idea, but he does it anyway. It's amazing. Yeah,
with all kinds of increasingly detailed information that could get him in trouble.
And we haven't even mentioned Terry O'Quinn is doing his best thing. Gil Bellows has some hilarious moments as a completely hapless guy in the piping industry. And Deborah Winger is in this season as the previously unseen mother of this dysfunctional spy family.
She is, and she's good. And the episode that she's introduced in, I don't know if it's like three or four, the episode she's introduced in, it was also one of the ones where I thought, you know, I'm teaching this class with my students, and I always talk to them about, like, you know, imagine yourself in a writer's room as you're watching these shows, and what decisions do they make or do they not make? Which are the good ones that they make? Like, did they go left when it was a predictable left, and then you felt a familiarity with the decision and didn't think anything of it because it was so familiar? Or did they veer right and you were like, huh, I didn't think they were going to do that. And then that's a sign of, especially if they pull it off, of creative thinking. And in Patriot, there's an episode where I was literally completely, and I always love when I'm completely surprised. And in this case, I was surprised in a joke format. It was another visual joke format, and not the, there's one that you got, everybody who watch listening to this will get to, and they'll know it's so broad. You know, it's the first time I think the show has ever gone that broad, but there's a subtle humor joke, and I laughed so hard, but at the same, when I was laughing, I was like, that was such a great decision that they made, because I was not expecting it at all, and it wasn't even in the realm of my thinking that that would be the joke. And of course it was like 100% hilarious. And it's just a decision that they made where I thought, I love it when I'm completely shocked by a decision. And it's very tiny minor scene as opposed to the one everyone will see and say, oh, this is the one Tim was talking about where they, you know, quadrupled down on this visual joke. But it just tells you that I think that they were really, they had some time to do it this year, this time, and they were on their game, and we'll see what happens if they get renewed. I'm happy, looking forward to it.
All right, go see it, everybody. Just it's on Amazon. Watch Patriot.
And start from the beginning. That's the thing, totally. Too. Don't rush. Definitely start from the beginning, because as much as they did an excellent job trying to recap the first, they just couldn't give it as much justice. I don't know what you thought when you watched it, but as I watched it, I was like, it reminded me of how many twists and turns there were, because I was like, oh yeah, I remember that, remember that, remember that. But then you're like, there's so much that they're leaving out. It's better if everybody just starts at season one.
Yeah, totally. It's there's a lot there. The story can just continue on. Don't jump ahead. All right, we should move on. Why don't you tell me about, so this is an interesting quirk where HBO made an American remake of Julia Davis's Camping, which you did not like. And they are pairing it now with Julia Davis's own original show, Sally Forever, which you do like.
Which I do like.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, it's... I think that the... You know, they're vastly different shows, and, you know, I didn't get to see the actual... I tried to get to see the actual Camping from her original one, but wasn't. But I was just able to see like a clip here and there. But the thing that was my aha moment was that I thought, the American version is dreadful. I would never even recommend anyone, the American version of Camping, would not recommend them watching it. But Juliette Lewis was the only one who could kind of pull off that kind of humor that Julia Davis, the British woman, is so good at. And it turns out, I did not know this, that Juliette Lewis's character, she's playing the Julia Davis character from the original. And I thought, oh, okay, that makes sense, because they both are like fearlessly diving into the role. And they do such a good job of that. And so she's back with Sally Forever, which is so incredibly bleak. It's not everybody's kind of humor. I loved it. And they only sent us three episodes of, I think, seven. And I laughed at all of them. It's so dark. Like, the thing with her is, you know, there's never an attempt for Julia Davis to take her foot off the gas on the darkness. She's never going to soften a character to make them more appealing, or like Americans would. It's not an issue of like whether you're going to like a character. It's just whether it's funny and whether you can go with that blackness.
Right.
And I actually did not even look to reread if it was kept in, but my favorite part when I wrote that review was that I'm a huge fan of Curb Your Enthusiasm, obviously one of the preeminent wince inducing comedies of our time. But I always say, like, you know, if you're a fan of Curb and that kind of wincing comedy is like, makes you like it, but it makes you uncomfortable. I mean, in comparison, like, Curb is like an episode of Arthur, the kids show, compared to anything that Julia Davis does. So just know that going into Sally Forever, that it's going to be kind of almost over the top bleak, but I loved it. There were so many funny laughs, she's a real, real talent.
All right. Sounds cool. Sounds good. Cringe comedy. Check it out. Now let's talk about a show that doesn't exist. This is an interesting notebook piece you wrote about the idea that David Simon is working on the third season of The Deuce for HBO. It's a show you really like. And yet your piece is basically like, but now is the perfect time to do a show based on. And this, we do live in a world, by the way, where magazine pieces get optioned to be movies and TV shows all the time and become those. And in this case, it is this New York Times piece by Jana Reitman about the rise of alt-right extremists and homegrown terrorism, and the fact that a lot of law enforcement agencies basically let it slide and turn their focus on other subjects, including sort of like they don't worry about domestic terrorism and white nationalism and things like that, but they do worry about and obsess about Islamic extremism, and that there's probably some pretty serious racist thought going behind it. There's a lot in the article about how it leads us to some pretty dark places as a society, and I like this piece because you're basically like, you can see the David Simon show that would emerge from this story.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
So is this basically Tim waves his hands and go, David Simon, read this article.
Well, it's funny because I think an accidental thing happened when I wrote this story that I should have known was a possibility, but didn't. Like I wanted to use, like, first of all, the story is just an amazing, from Janet Reitman, it's just an amazing piece of work. It's really long. I would encourage anyone who has not read it in the New York Times to go read it. And there's not an ounce of me that doubts this will be turned into a television series. I just hope it's not like a mini series. I hope it's an ongoing story, which is harder to do. And that's kind of why I thought, like, generally what happens is, you know, something like Too Big to Fail, they take a really great book and a great story, and then they make a mini series out of it. That's kind of the direction of how these things go, because making a series for 5 years is much more difficult. You need to have people who are master storytellers to keep a story alive for that long and draw out all these connections. Well, the first thing that I found when I read the story is, like, there's so many endless, interconnected, amazing institutional failures in that mimics The Wire, that David Simon, as a former journalist, would be perfect for this. But my goal when I was writing it was to say, David Simon would be perfect for this. He is literally the first person I thought of. He'd be perfect for it. But I wanted to get semi-quickly to the point, and because no one does work like he does, or has books already, on the shelves and in series made from them. It's just a slam dunk. He's the first choice. But my point was to say it could be him or it could be other people.
But it is in his wheelhouse, and you think of him because it is about societal dysfunction, criticizing our society as large, and also understanding the role that law enforcement plays for good and ill in the larger story, which is like, that's his bag.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just, you can remember, and I think it was the first or second season of The Wire, probably first, where it's been so long, where there's the clear demarcation where the United States moves from the war on drugs to the war on terror, and they basically literally like pick up shop. And there, you know, there's the Baltimore cops are trying to say, hey, can we have some of your cool electronic surveillance stuff so we can use it to stop our city from being under siege? But I didn't put David Simon's name into the headline and the photo. So there's my idea was like he'd be perfect for it. But anybody who was a good writer would bask at the chance to take the story and run with it. But of course, they put him in the headline.
Pumped it up with David Simon.
Yeah, and if I was going to do that, I would have tweeted it out with his, this. And I know
AO Despair
very well.
So you know what happened, which is that Wendell Pierce tweeted a link to your article, who is Bunk on The Wire, and David Simon replied, "Wendell, please, I'm busy looking at porn." and somebody actually asked him what kind of porn. He said, "It's a subset of BDSM in which a middle-aged writer ties up a young lady and then forces her to listen while he reads her old newspaper clippings and scenes cut from old television scripts." Although actor James Purefoy replied to his tweet and said, I'd walk 10 miles barefoot over broken glass to be a part of that show. So, you know, we're casting it on Twitter.
I love it.
This invisible show, we're casting it on Twitter. But I get your point, which is like, sometimes you're using, you know, you're referring to people and stuff to make a larger point, and then they... And you don't call them out, and then they notice, and you're like, "Oh, geez, like that's not what I was trying to do. I wasn't trying to bring you into this.
I didn't want to throw him in there. Yeah, and it's the funny thing is, I've known David for a number of years since basically through The Wire, which is ages ago. And of course, the last time I saw him, I interviewed him in the summer, and Blown Deadline Productions and Nina Noble for all of the stuff that he's done for over 20 years at the ATX Festival. And, you know, it was there we were talking, and he was talking about Trump and saying, you know, we're trying to do this Capitol Hill series. We're trying to do something about Trump, and we've literally thrown out two entire ideas and written scripts. And so I knew that, and I put that in the story, but of course the third go round got picked up like 3 days after my story came out. So it was basically like David Simon's going to do this, you know, book on the rise of you know, basically Nazism and white hate in the alt right. And Leslie Goldberg from THR was like, "Hey, if I had known you were going to do your piece, I would have told you that we were waiting to drop this piece." But as I said to her, I was like, "Yeah, I didn't know that it had that we were about to drop this like exclusive or whatever. I knew it was in the works." And I tried to tell her, like, it still works for me. It doesn't have to be him. And then I joked that, like, hey, he's a former newspaper writer. He can do two things at once. Yeah, he can multitask.
Also, his deal is for, it's an adaptation of Philip Roth's The Plot Against America. It's a miniseries, right. And it's basically alt history. So it's a way to talk about a fascist America. So obviously commenting on things that are going around today, but using as is great, using science fiction, essentially, to talk about it with a layer of metaphor, and that sounds great, but you know, I'm sure he can work harder.
He can work harder, and the story itself remains. Well, the funny thing about that too is that, like, what, like, we've already talked about this the last week, you know, a week prior, and the other podcast we talked about, you know, The Man in the High Castle was this, the whole story I wrote about it already is the allegory, Trump era allegory of our times, weirdly, in its third season, and drawing the connections of how it missed, the first two seasons actually missed the Trump era because he wasn't even elected yet. So it's been done. The thing that Simon's going to do is already being done right now with The Man in the High Castle. But yeah, it's one of those clunky things where, like, you know, maybe I shouldn't have put him at the top. He is the most obvious idea, because I don't want any to lose focus on the fact that I think that this story it's amazing. Like, I could just, and anybody who makes television for a living or it will, I'm sure, is frothing to make this. But it'll, you know, the more likelihood is that it'll probably end up as a miniseries. But boy, I would really love it to go five seasons, just because if you read that New York Times story from Jenna Ryman, you will, and it's linked in my story, you will see the myriad possibilities of where you can take this. So I hope it gets made. I'm sure it will get made.
Yeah, awesome. All right, you want to do some letters?
Let's do that.
All right. Oh, before we do that, I will mention, and this is in the shameless screener plug thing, season 2 of Mars is appearing on Nat Geo. Shout out to Stephanie and the 202 for that.
Yay, Stephanie. Watched
the first episode of it, and I enjoyed it. It is, you know, it's not going to be everybody's cup of tea, because it's a hybrid thing where there's some scripted drama interleaved with, like, interviews and stuff, and the whole idea is that you're kind of, like, trying to... not only show, like, what the future of space exploration might be, but also have people who are involved in space exploration today talk about what the issues are. So it's kind of this, you know, educational / scripted. It's a hybrid. It's weird.
Yeah, it's a hybrid. Mm-hmm.
But it's fun. If you like space stuff like me, you're gonna like it. So there you go.
Yeah, and I don't know if you're gonna if I'm Columboing you right before we get to the letters. because I'm not sure.
Well, I humbled myself, as so often happens here, by introducing the letters and then doing something that wasn't letters.
Well, I was just going to say, I didn't know if you had seen in the recent Twitter sphere that Amazon Prime Video retweeted my review of Patriot, and their comment at the top was, "Not gonna lie, we play Afternoon Spray from season one on the regular," and then they have a link to one of the folk songs from season one.
Oh yeah, Afternoon Spray, which is a song that is in season one. Yes, yeah. Indeed.
So there you go.
Amazing. Hashtag Patriot. Again, Amazon Prime Video. Come on. Hashtag Sat Spies. Just add it.
Just add it.
There's Sat Spies on that show. All right. First off, I want to start with a taunt we received on Twitter from TV Line's Matt Mitovich. We talked to Matt.
Yes.
We talk about Matt because they did, TV Line does that excellent fall premiere calendar, and it wasn't updated, and he felt really bad when he heard that, and he updated it and all of that. And now he's taunting us because he tweeted, "I've seen new Counterpart episodes, and maybe you haven't. Ha, 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 ha."
He's right. It's funny. I always take Matt's joke was funny because I am guilty of taking all of these things that I get in advance and just stacking them up. And the joke goes back to when I would get like the first four episodes of way back in The Sopranos, when those were just gold, and people would be like, and they were coming in like VHS tapes, and people would be like, "Why are you not watching this?" You know, to the point where you and I would joke when I would get, I was like, "Oh, hey, I have the first like four or six episodes of Game of Thrones." And you're like, "What?
Yeah.
It's not coming out for another month."
Yeah, that's how I experienced the first half of the first season of Game of Thrones, is that I watched the screeners without the special effects.
Yes, it was quite odd. So I have a history of getting things and then sort of sitting on them because you're overwhelmed /PeakTV.
Yeah, and you're not going to write about it yet. So you just wait until it's closer and then write about it then.
Absolutely. So there's a possibility that I saw his thing and I was like, "Do I have Counterparts sitting in a stack, like in my pile?" I don't think I do, actually. So he is definitely ahead of me. But yes, did taunt us.
There was a film festival somewhere where they premiered at least one episode, at least the first episode of season two. I saw that pass by, that they had done.
Wow.
They had done that and unlocked that, and they've done a trailer and all that. And it's coming soon. It's coming, I think, in a month. So, but anyway, Matt, we hear you, and I grumbled at that because, yeah, I would love to see new Counterpart episodes, but there's so much other TV. It'll be here, and it'll be great when it gets here. I got Sad Spies to keep me company in the meantime. Our friend Mai Vogon Poetry tweeted at us, "One of the things I miss in the TV times of confusion is talking about shows with friends. Almost no one watches shows live, and you don't want to spoil plots for them. Since the volume of TV is like books, do we need a TVTM TV club?" To which I say, is the TVTM not that? Do
right.
we not discuss television here? But I do, I mean, on The Incomparable, we'll do TV episodes, and it's very much like I wait for the whole season to spool out, and then I wait for time to pass, and then we talk about them, and it's a podcast, so you can listen at your leisure. And I mean, at least for me, that's what I recommend, because I like podcasts, and I know people who listen to this, 100% of them listen to podcasts, because this is a podcast. So it's just the math. Just do the math. So what I would say is, if there's a show you're really liking, see if you can find a podcast about it. And we have some at The Incomparable, but they're all over the internet. There are podcasts about TV shows. And the nice thing is, you can listen after you watch. And then it's like, you don't necessarily get, you can talk back to the podcast. You don't get to actually talk, but you can talk back to the podcast about it and hear people talking about it. Because I agree that this is a thing that we all miss now, because mm-hmm. everybody's watching TV out of sync. And that's too bad, but that's sort of where we are.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and one of the great things, I mean, it only happens now on sporting events or, unfortunately, tragic news, and the tragic news that we see on cable, is that, like, our shared cultural experience used to be, you know, used to be television, where you could talk about The Sopranos or Lost or something that had grabbed you, you know, and we could, every episode could be like a weekly, like, "Oh, we're all caught up on episode two, because that's the only episode that's aired." Now it's just it's impossible. Yeah. So the whole water cooler experience is over in television.
Yeah. Anyway, so I say podcasts might be a way to alleviate some of that. And now it's letter time. This one comes from Josh in the 416. That's Toronto. So continuing our
Tirana.
Yeah, Tirana. Yeah, I know. I say it for like people to know what I'm talking about, even though they don't call it that, Tirana. Just like Montreal. I don't say Montreal, even though that's how they call it.
I don't either.
Montreal. And shout out to Van City, even though they didn't write in. Josh says, one of the big news about TV items in Canada the past couple of weeks is Crave TV, the Bell Canada streaming service, likely best known to TVTM listeners as the originators of Letterkenny, yes, merging with TMN, Bell's pay movie channel, where HBO and Showtime programs were airing. So those who are subscribed to TMN on cable now get everything else that was already on the Crave On Demand, including Letterkenny and a big chunk of the Comedy Central back catalog, but with a few cooking and reality shows like Jersey Shore that don't seem to fit in with the rest. While Cord Cutters can upgrade to a new Crave Movies and HBO tier, which adds everything that used to be exclusive to TMN. It's been mostly received positively, though some are complaining the new tier's $20 Canadian price point, even though HBO Now stateside is almost the same at $15 US. TMN's old multiplex cable channel still exist under the Crave name, but much of the marketing emphasis is on the Netflix-style streaming, and I wouldn't be surprised if they begin phasing out the linear channels within the next year or so. Do you get the chance that this is the direction that your premium services like HBO and Showtime might be heading in as well? Or is it possible that it could go the other way and the likes of Netflix and Hulu start adding curated linear streams to complement their on-demand offerings? Love to your mothers, Josh in the 416, Tirana. So, Tim, what about this? This is one of these great mysteries, is what is the fate of linear TV if you emphasize streaming and if you have both? How do you coordinate those things? Is there going to come a time when HBO says, look, just stream it, forget about it? Or is there going to come a time when a streaming service is like, I guess we have this, like Disney, like they got a lot of cable channels. We got these linear channels. Maybe we should just program some stuff on them. Or what happens here? Where does this go?
Well, we touched on this a little bit last week too, where it kind of gave me a headache, because you can't write off of, a whole industry. You can't write them off so quickly, even though we've kind of moved on to more of a streaming thing, and I prefer everything to be streamed now. And we talked about how our DVRs were virtually empty except for Warriors games and such. I don't know, because I don't want to. I know that there's ad revenue to be made there. I think that there's, you know, AMC is doing a really interesting thing where they don't really have a separate OTT over-the-top aspect of getting cable if you don't already have, you know, you have to prove that you're a subscriber. And the reason they do that is because, you know, they get so much of their money from their subscribers. And they're doing it with some of their smaller channels like Shudder and I think Sundance Now, who actually have separate OTTs. I think that it's going to be hard for the more established cable channel ones to give up the money. That's,
I mean, they're getting paid
per
subscriber on cable. So they're going to, as long as that is profitable for them, they're going to want to keep getting the money that way.
Yeah. And I think it's going to be, still some time. If you're looking in a crystal ball, I would always bet on technology shifting to the point where, you know, I bet if we had this conversation many, many years ago about Netflix, people would be, you know, we would have hedged our bet that this tiny little thing that they're trying to do with streaming could work, but I wouldn't rule out the mailed packages in the red envelopes. And of course now that's ridiculous to even think that. So I think in the future I would be very concerned if I was running a linear cable channel, but right now not yet.
Yeah. I get the feeling that it's going to be like, you know, increasingly an older audience and a smaller audience that's watching linear, and it will keep going until it's no longer profitable for it to be there. And in the end, it's going to be for people our age and older, maybe.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And it'll fade
away. I mean, that's
away.
The thing, right? That's what people were still saying, newspapers are dead, and yet you still see them.
Yeah. It's just the demographic for them is very different than it used mm-hmm. to be. This is from our friend Yehuda in the +41, which is Switzerland.
Yes.
And Yehuda writes, "Hi guys, long time since I last wrote in. Here's a thought. I just finished watching Homecoming on Amazon Prime, and while I was watching, I realized that short of some F-bombs here and there, here was a series with no violence, no nudity, essentially nothing that would disqualify this show from appearing on the yet-to-be-announced Apple Video streaming service. And yet, this was definitely a mature, intelligent, classy, highbrow show. I realize there aren't many Sam S. males around. In fact, there is only one accomplished series creator by that name. But this show gave me some hope that if Apple plays their cards right, while not being too rigid about their standards, and end up signing on people of a certain caliber able to deliver something as refined as Homecoming, maybe, just maybe, we might get a service that elevates quality over quantity, content over snazzy effects, story and exposition over filler and repetitiveness. As far as the show itself, I was mesmerized. Without giving anything away, S-Mail creates a certain conceit, then appears to be messing with it toward the end, until you realize he's actually being extremely consistent all the way through, except you as the viewer were misinterpreting what it was all about. He does things with sound that are clever, and as in Mr. Robot, moves the camera like nobody else on the tube. This level of intelligence on TV is still rare, even in this platinum age of television. Thank you guys for bringing this little gem to our attention. I'll continue to tune in weekly to TVTM for good advice on what to watch next, unless you guys finally decide to go down under and turn this into a National Geographic podcast after all. Yehuda in the +41.
Yes. I think we actually even kind of dipped our toes into this last week. Where we talked about, like, you know,
if every show Apple does is as good as Homecoming, it'll be doing great, right?
Yeah, it's just really hard to do what they do. And I think when you're paying for something and it has one or two, like, family-friendly shows that maybe are well done, that don't have graphic violence and stuff and sexuality in them, that they would work. But the odds of an actual person pulling that off is, and consistently for when you get up to 10, 15 series that you're paying for, the odds drop dramatically. And I think, as we both noted, that, like, if you're a series creator, you don't want to limit yourself to not being able to do something because something might come up and you're just like, you know what, I would really like to have a mature sex scene here, or I would really like to have something that your standards are telling me I can't produce. They don't want to be limited, but it's certainly possible.
All right, one last letter. This is from Matt from the 330. This is not Matt Mitovich, I don't believe, mocking us again. But this is good. Matt is trying to help me here. It says, Jason, I want to urge you to join the shamefully nerdy world of planning your TV scheduling via spreadsheet. I've been doing this for years, and it would be great to know I'm not the only one. It might seem ridiculous. For instance, I'm scheduled to watch the first episode of Sad Spies Season 2 tonight, but I found it really useful in moderating my TV load and suppressing some of that overwhelming feeling. When Tim suddenly praises some random show like Detectorist, I can see if I've got some room for it, or when I find myself enjoying a show less, I can see if it might be better to drop it because there's a lot of TV coming. The best part of it is the satisfaction I get when I clear an episode off my spreadsheet after watching it. It makes me feel like I've accomplished something rather than just sitting around watching TV. Love to the other overly organized TV watchers out there, Matt from the 330. Now, I've mentioned this before, like, I do try to program it, and what happens is that sometimes I kind of fall off the wagon because there's, like, I'm not clear where to go next, and I haven't put up a list, and then I've kind of fallen apart. So I think that having some sort of system where you've got a queue, and so you're not, like, overwhelmed by all choice, you've got, like, a show or two shows or four shows or whatever it is that you're going through in the slow binge, I find that is an effective way to do it. I have not built a spreadsheet yet, but I do think that Matt's got something here, that one way to stop being as confused in the times of confusion is to try to, you know, set some ground rules. Like, we're going to only watch, you know, instead of binging through one show, we're going to watch four shows and we're going to watch them in this order. I had a very successful time last summer doing the Amazon comedy block, where it was like we went through all of Red Oaks and most of Mozart in the Jungle together, back to back, as like a comedy block. So you watch one, watch one or the other, and that's it. And then you don't watch anymore until the next day if you want to. And then maybe you stick a drama after those and you've programmed your own little show. That was really effective. It's just, you know, it's worth trying. I just kind of fell out of the habit and I need to get back in it because I have felt overwhelmed lately.
Yes, I like it too. Anything that can, I remember when you first talked about that idea on Amazon of doing the Red That was really good. Yeah, I'm all for people sort of feeling connected because I and organized because I'm not. And right. This past week,
we admire you.
Well, it's funny because Dan and I just connected again about what's coming up the rest of November, and there's really not a lot. I mean, we've done stuff in advance. I just did. This Showtime has a huge limited series called Escape at Dannemora. And about this famous prison escape in 2015. And, you know, it's not coming up until, like, later, but I had to, for print, I had to watch all of these episodes now. And I'm just, it's like those, and then, of course, we looked today, Dan and I, and there's, like, not much left. And I was like, oh, hey, here's a time where I don't feel like I'm pressured to watch shows. I would really like to get myself organized and finish off the rest of the ones that I haven't started. So I'm all for organizing and feeling less overwhelmed.
All right, we approve, Matt. You're probably not alone. I mean, we don't know, but probably not. If other people have other ways that they try to program their binge watching / streaming queue, send them in. Let us know. I think that would be kind of interesting, and it'll mean that Matt isn't alone. You can do that by tweeting us at TVTM or by emailing us at podcast@tvtalkmachine.com. And Tim, unless you would like to Columbo me, I think that brings us to the end of this week's episode.
No, I would only like to say goodbye, everybody.
I, too, agree. Goodbye to all everywhere, especially in Australia. Those who survive in Australia, we say, good job. You lasted another week. Don't listen to this while you're running outside, or you may have a animal either emerge from the water or drop from a tree and kill you. But otherwise, to all those who survive, goodbye, everybody.